I'm now going to talk about something that it was my biggest insight, let me put it that way, when I studied this stuff really seriously in Rome 4 years ago. It was a new idea for me as a absolutely basic idea. Like, you know how you have ideas in your mind that you're kind of familiar with, but then suddenly you realise that they're really crucial and really basic and totally central. So that's what I came to realise, that's what I want to share to you now, because I was working under an assumption that I hadn't really thought through, like most assumptions, that, for example, Jeremiah wrote, and what he said was in the book, and that was written down, and that's what I'm reading. And I was aware that other people had also written some of it, and we didn't know who they were, and I was reading them. But I wasn't aware, fully aware, or I don't know what word to use, of the whole way in which the scrolls were alive and grew. Anything but a fixed text. So that's my insight. I'll now share it with you. The Older Testament, I like calling it the Older Testament rather than the Old Testament. Only because of the way words have got nuances. Old could sound, except to someone who's 74, I'd never accept this. It could sound old, meaning out of date or something like that, as distinct from new, you know. Whereas the Older Testament and the newer don't have any particular, to me, as words, they don't say anything about. Anyhow, the Older Testament is the fruit of centuries of reflection by people who were convinced that their God, whom they called Yahweh, the Lord of creation and the Lord of history, had chosen them in love and had a special mission for them in the world. And of course, God does. God has a special mission for every culture, every group, every person, every religion. You know, we're not talking narrowly here, but Judaism did have a wonderful role. And when you compare the writings, say, of the Jewish scriptures, even compare them to the Quran, which is written 1,000 years later, God help, there's no comparison. The Jewish scriptures are so much more profound and beautiful. I'm speaking now as a Christian, as neither, but they really are. They're just, all you've got to do is read them to see that. So we're dealing with extraordinary culture here that's still an extraordinary culture and still alive and well in our world. Thanks be to God. I just wish we'd all get together again, and I just wish that what the New Testament people, those who became Christians, reached out to their brothers and sisters and said, like Paul, you know, this is the way to be a Jew. Like, if you really, really, really want to be a Jew and follow Moses and follow Abraham, and who's the father of many nations, don't stay locked into your culture. Open it up. Universal. That's what Christianity is, really, is Judaism taken to the world. So do that. But most didn't do it. Most of us are stuck in our ways a bit. Not too many of us are brave enough to, what about you, but, you know, looking at our world. I mean, to be as open as Jesus was and then as open as Paul was is likely to get you crucified or your head chopped off. So I wouldn't be advising it. Okay, but they knew they had a special mission, and they were right. It'd be wonderful if every culture had that feeling. They believed that there was a special providence guiding their history. They kept reflecting on it. What happened to that little group of escaped prisoners, slaves from Egypt, and what happened when this happened, and look at what's happened in our history, and they felt the presence of God in it. The only nation that should think that's outdone them, of course, are the Irish. if we look at our history, I mean, Jews eat your heart out. I mean, this is the real culture. I'm only 3/4 Irish, you might guess. Anyhow, all cultures have got something to say. So, but they read that God was guiding their history. They kept reflecting on it to remember God's love and God's covenant and to discern God's will, the movement of God's inspiration in our world, as well as to learn from their mistakes. So become more sensitive, more attentive, more faithful. Jerusalem was destroyed for reasons they had, which were, I think, wrong, but I'll talk about that in a minute. But Jews, so they didn't want to go through that again, so they wanted to pore over Jeremiah's words to see where did we go wrong and let's not go wrong again. A pretty sensible attitude. They cherished their traditions, including the reflections of those who went before them. Amos, Hosea, Micah, we'll be doing them soon. But they knew, here's my point, that no words, however sacred, can comprehend the mystery that is God. And so they kept questioning, they kept refining, they kept adapting earlier insights in the light of newer revelation. It's exactly what the New Testament is, by the way. The people who wrote the New Testament were just in a long tradition of doing this. Okay, Jeremiah did have something to say, but 200 years later, in the light of an exile and something else, can't you see the people thought, ah, there's more in this. So the scroll encourages them to update it, enlighten it, shape it differently, say what Jeremiah would have said today were he here. Do you get it? And it's in Jeremiah's name. Like a Jesuit, general of the Jesuit order might write a thing about what would Ignatius say to us Jesuits in the 21st century. Well, and it's in an Ignatian anthology. Or I might say, talking about our founder, Jules Chevalier, 150 years ago and a bit more, what would he say today? And maybe I could write an article for our province and people might say, God, that's right. Or they might say, good, where's this bloke off with the fairies? But so you're keeping a tradition alive. That's what the Bible is. Till it gets printed, written down, locked in, and that happened in the first century AD. Prior to that, it's bubbling over, being refreshed all the time. Very important insight. And in the New Testament, of course, with Jesus, Paul then looks back at the stuff that's in Exodus or Genesis or Isaiah and sees it in a new light. Do you get it? In the light of Jesus' experience. Ah! Isaiah was reaching for an insight back then in his own time, but look, it's fulfilled here in Jesus. It's better than Isaiah ever thought, but it's consistent with his thinking. So, okay. Since they believed that it was God himself who was communicating with his people through the events of their history, the authors readily prefaced their inspired insights with expressions such as, Yahweh said. You find it all the way through. Yahweh said. Don't forget what I just read to you before the first break. Other people were saying Yahweh said too, but they were wrong. So it needs checking. But they spoke out of what they thought Yahweh was saying. Sometimes they were right, sometimes they were wrong. But they were always imperfect. A way of stating that the words that followed expressed God's will as best they were able to discern it. What else can you do? It was the community that accepted their word that gave it that special place in the memory of the people. They expected that God's will would be beyond their ability to comprehend fully. Surely we know that. When people fight over words in God's name, you've got to say, oh, come on. You've got to hold on to truths. You've got to say to someone like the church did at the time of the Reformation, to people who said, look, the Mass, the Eucharist is just a meal remembering Jesus. Well, it looks like that if you want to look at it like that, but it's not that. So the church had to say, no, yeah, you're wrong. And they found words to try to say, no, it's more, it's Jesus truly present here nourishing us with his life. You can't just put it off as a little party that we're having, remembering what happened 2,000 years ago. So we've got to hold on to, and we've got to correct, you've got to correct me, I've got to correct you, we've got to try and grapple for the truth. But it's always growing. and I think I've often said to you, and I hope it makes sense to you, theology, all theology does, it doesn't encapsulate God. But it does, like good science, it tells us what's wrong so we don't head off, hurtle off in that going nowhere dead end. But good theology faces us towards the mystery in the right direction. But that's all it does. The actual encompassing of the mystery is beyond us, but we're at least being drawn into the mystery if our mind is holding these thoughts lightly. Do you see what I'm trying to get at? Hope you do. So they expected that God's will would be beyond their ability to comprehend fully. So they approached the inspired words expecting that there'd be many hidden meanings to be discovered there. As we do with literature. Shakespeare writes a sonnet on love. Now, once you write something, it's bigger than anything you've thought. And people will see in it, in that inspired poetry, meanings that Shakespeare would have thought, oh, God, that's right. Didn't think of that, but that's what I was trying to get at, you know? Isn't that what happens in art all the time? So there'd be hidden meanings. They liked to break open the word to see the sparks of light that issued from it, revealing the divine enlightenment hidden within. So they pored over the texts. The texts expressed inspired insights into the presence and actions of a living God in their history. No text could hold it all. And so the history of the development of the Old Testament is the history of this prayerful debate, discussion and refinement, always in the light of historical experiences. I think the best way to imagine the Bible being written, and by the way, most of it, the central parts, were written in exile. So I think the best way to imagine it is to imagine in a little synagogue, and you've got a dozen scholars from different walks of life who know the scriptures and love it, and they're debating over it, like the Jews still do, and arguing and saying, no, when Isaiah said that, he didn't really, that's not what he meant, and then out of that comes a text that encapsulates the wisdom of that group. Faithful group, hopefully, a prayerful group, but it's a debating, discussing, energetic tussle, not God inspires them and somebody without a brain in his head just types it all out on a book and gives it to him and says, oh, God said it, so that's it. It doesn't work like that, does it? Okay, to finish this point, in his History of Prophecy in Israel, page 3, Joseph Blenkinsop, a very good scholar, by the way, if you see in... I'm reading books and books and books. I never read anything light-hearted, I have to tell you, anyhow. Scholarly books are very hard to read nearly always because of the way they're written. They're not written to be read. They're written for scholars, and they've got footnotes, and they've got Hebrew, and they've got Greek, and they've got Septuagint, and they've got this, and they've got Aramaic. And that's what I have to read. But I have to read, hopefully, that's not what I'm writing. I'm trying to write something a bit. But Blenkinsop, if you see his name anywhere, get the book and read it. He actually writes in a flowing, intelligent, scholarly, a good way. So I'm recommending him for you because I'm surprised how well he writes. Well, he says this, talking about the prophetic books of the Old Testament, he says it's a cumulative process of appropriation, assimilation and adaptation that shades off into an increasingly frequent recycling and reinterpreting of older prophetic material. That's got it. It's a bit fast giving it to you. Do you get the feel of it? It's recycling, reimagining, reorganizing, rethinking, readapting in the light of later experience. So the text is alive, kept alive. The editors responsible for the prophetic scrolls were faithful to the words, of course they were, words in the text that were originally spoken but are written. They saw the words as an inspired expression of the action of Yahweh in their history. So they pored over them, wanted to discover the will of Yahweh in them. They reflected on the meaning of past events for them and for their contemporaries, and they felt free to edit and present the text accordingly. Why that took me so long to get that insight was because we don't do that today. If you wrote something and I was critiquing it, I'd be very careful to have what you wrote, wouldn't I? And in a footnote, I'd put my comments or somewhere else. But I wouldn't change the text. They did. They kept it alive. Here's Blenkinsop again. As difficult and hypothetical as it is, no doubt, the reconstruction of the editorial history of prophetic books remains a task of major importance historically and theologically. Very difficult, I can assure you, to try and trace how this book developed. It's kind of impossible, but it's a task that scholars set themselves, and I'm glad they do. It's a scientific task that's well worth doing, and I hope I've communicated to you the essential insight in it, that we are dealing with a text that develops over time. A few comments on the subject of inspiration. Surely, inspiration, if we're going to ask what does it mean, must be speaking about the presence of God's Spirit guiding people in their lives and in their teaching. God's guiding me now. How much am I listening is the point. Do you get it? God's guiding you as a mother or a grandparent. God is guiding all of us. The level of our listening is the problem, and the level of our awareness and all that other. So, but we're human beings. We've just got to give it our best shot. So back to the text here. He's guiding people in their lives and in their teaching, including those who composed the final text. So God was guiding those rabbis in Babylon as they pored over their text. God was guiding the apostles, early church, as they read the old scriptures in the light of their experience of Jesus. God is guiding the people in the Vatican, hopefully, to organise the church well. No, I don't mean that to be... I just mean, you know, God's guiding us all, so we've got to listen. But they are necessarily limited human expression of their faith convictions. For in the final analysis, it's the community of believers that recognises the texts as inspired. When they left Jerusalem, they took the scroll with them. There could have been other scrolls around, and they thought, oh, like you do. You're moving. I moved from Kippax to, where am I now, Dixon. And I took a lot of stuff with me. Probably too much of my own files and that. But there are things I left behind because they're not worth it to me anymore. Do you know what I mean? And I presume you do that when you clean up, when you move house. So somebody writes a poem and you really love it and you keep it. You might grow beyond it. And when you get to a certain age, you read and you think, I wonder why I like this. It doesn't really... So you let it go. Other things you keep. And so what we've got in the Bible is stuff that they kept. And kept keeping. Do you get it? So one should approach it expecting it's going to be pretty valuable. Necessarily limited and all that. But if a community continues to find it inspiring, they'll want to inspire their kids with it. So they won't want it to get lost. To say that these texts are inspired is to say that God was guiding his people. And that this guidance includes a special providence in guiding the writings in which their history is expressed in much the same way Christians trust the Spirit of Jesus is with us, guiding us to the fullness of truth, as the scriptures say. And that doesn't mean that some of the popes at the time of the Enlightenment or of the pre-Reformation period, who were clearly, God will help us, their families got them into the job and they didn't want to be in the job. And they had to take celibacy to be part of it, but they, I mean, how are you going to be celibate for God's sake? So they had their woman down the road to kind of drive in their chariot. But they didn't have newspapers in those days to blast it out everywhere. So Alexander the Sixth had a bit of a history, really. And it's quite interesting. If it happened today, of course, it'd be a blah, blah. But why am I picking on Alexander the Sixth? Probably because he was a Spaniard. Anyhow, so there's history. We go through our history. We live through our history. We survived Judas and we survived Peter denying Jesus, didn't we? And we just survived the apostles running away because they're human beings and they weren't up for it. So I'm not always up for it. You're not always up for it. We have to forgive. We have to learn. We have to get on with it. But we're human beings. And so are all these people. So we've got to treat them gently but courageously. So the Spirit of Jesus is guiding us, but it doesn't mean we're always listening to the guidance. And we've got to be able to learn with other people's failures, and we've got to learn to live with our own. The authority of Scripture lies in the power the texts have to transform people's lives. So your question, in a way, is, if I understand it correctly, and correct me if I'm wrong, is when the texts found a fixed form, a kind of why did that happen and when, and is a bit like that. Basically, it was like this. Two things, Christianity as a phenomenon itself, and the second thing was the destruction of Jerusalem by the Roman army in the year 70 AD. Both these events in that part of the world shattered their confidence in who they were, shattered their world, really, because Christians were kind of, Judaism was bleeding. A lot of the best people, you might say, were going into Christianity, and they were opening up things, and there were Greeks entering in without circumcision, and they weren't. The Jews that were Christians kept doing all the Jewish things. They kept going to the synagogue and the temple and all of that till they were told they couldn't come anymore, because they were winning over converts from this religious group, basically because they were so loving and so open and so refreshing and so whatever. Christianity is quite a beautiful religion. So that was happening. So what do we do about that? What do we, the Jewish people, do about that? Secondly, you've got then the destruction of their city, the Romans coming in, and the whole. So this group of rabbis went to a place called Yavne, it's got different names depending on what you pronounce it, on the coast of the Mediterranean, and they're not sure, but about 80 or 90 AD, it's a bit vague, and they sat down and they determined, for the first time really, what books are ours, you know. They're being reinterpreted now by the Christians in a way we don't like, because they're making Jesus into the Messiah. Do you get me? So what books are ours? And there was a bit of debate, and the debate went on for centuries too. It wasn't. But they did fix what's called a canon. That is a canon in Greek means a ruler, a rule where you could recognize these are our books, these aren't our books. And they had a couple of criteria for that. One was that they had to be in Hebrew, our language, and they had to be ancient, basically. Some of them weren't as ancient as they thought they were, because they didn't have the Fisher Library to go and check everything in. And so there were Jewish writings written in Greek. They knew that from Alexandria, where the Jews were. Well, they were not considered part of the sacred text, and a lot of them went on into Christianity too and became important books, and they're in our Bibles, but they weren't accepted by this. So that's the best answer. They kind of fixed it for security. And by the way, that is nearly always what we do. Move into the Catholic Church, of which I'm a member, as you probably know. When the Church came out with its dogma about the Eucharist, which I half talked about before, you don't say anything if everyone knows it and believes it. It's when someone threatens it that you think, hey, wait a minute, we better clarify this. So when people said that the Mass is just a memory, as some people did, and we don't need priesthood and whatever to do that, we don't need the sacraments because Jesus is what we're present, etc., then the Church had to come up at the Council of Trent and say, no, that's not our tradition, this is our tradition. So they lay it down. It's not that that's the first time they believed it, but they were kind of forced into putting it in hard words which is always a problem. Because once, like that was the problem of theology ever since the Reformation period, is what the church accented at that time were the things that people disagreed with. But there was all these other things we agreed with that nobody said anything about because they agreed. And so these seemed to become important and the others tended to be neglected. But it's pretty well the normal process. Is that okay? Mm-hmm. Now I want to talk about two... serious assumptions that are all the way through the prophets that seem to me to be wrong. So you're going to find them all over the place. And if I'm right, they're wrong. So you have to work that out a bit. Okay, so they're kind of basic assumptions that belong to their time that I would see very differently. I think we all would, but that's up to you to check. One is we'll start before I move into them. Many concepts of God that you've got and that I've got and that Paisley had and that the Pope has and that everybody has, many concepts of God are clearly erroneous. So here's a checklist for you. The God who controls the world from outside, that's almost still universally in people's mind, a lot of people's mind. Why doesn't God stop the war? Why did God, after 10 years, allow bin Laden to be captured? Why wasn't he captured a year ago? Why didn't Hitler have a heart attack, for God's sake, before he got stuck into all the Jews in the Second World War and the rest of them? Because God can surely organise heart attacks, can't he? So why didn't this happen? Why didn't that happen? Why did my child die young? Or why did my daughter's pregnancy not come to term? And it was all these things that happen in our world, and we can behave as though God is controlling all this, and therefore ask questions of why didn't God do something? A God who's exalted at the expense of humanity. We genuflect to God and then go home and treat your wife or your husband or your kids like dirt. Or you bow down to Allah or whoever it might be, or you go like this at the wall, at the holy wall in Jerusalem, and then you go out and shoot, kill, destroy, maim, starve, and the prophets are going to be full of this, trade systems that deprive the poor and suit you, and put a big carbon footprint all over the world, and then listen to half the politicians saying it's just phony. Am I talking? You get with me? Well, that kind of a God. A God who upholds vested interests. Who justifies the successful. If successful, God blesses you if you're successful. Who supports apartheid. Patriarchy. Oh, no. We can't have women. It's a place for women, of course, but not here. Hypocritical piety. You're all blushing. Immature dependency. Instead of growing up and thinking and taking decisions and being honest about them, God seems to be slotted in as an answer to things. Infantile illusions. You don't have to read Freud and these people to realise what's going on in the psychiatric field because of religious ideas that are balmy. So it's a wonder any of us are sane. Hope we are. You're looking pretty good. So God can be a projection of our fears. Another word for fate, the stars, demons. God can be a projection of our needs for self-indulgence, prestige, power. God can be the support of our insecurity. anchoring a meaningless life in submission to this power object out there, up there, over there. So we shouldn't expect the prophets to be completely free from some of these erroneous ways of thinking, and it's going to be totally obvious that they're not completely free from them, because they're just blokes, and they belong to a certain period of time. And if God's going to inspire someone to say something to the community that's meaningful and really dramatic, he has to inspire an immature human being to do it, because there aren't any others. There are limited human beings. There are no unlimited one that God can choose to inspire. So I'm going to suggest to you two critical, universally, they're all the way through the text. And if you're not alert to this, the text will end up corrupting your idea of God, even though it's a holy text from the Bible. And part of our wrong concepts of God is because of the Bible. Not read with the eyes of Jesus, but read just as it is. Now, that should be totally obvious to you. So we're all in a dangerous place here. Some people are aware of the danger and tread lightly. Some people are totally unaware of it and they become religious bullies. Let's try the two things. One, monotheism in the Bible, right through in the prophets, is defective. If one genuinely believes that it is the one God who's at the heart of everything and is expressed and revealed through everything, then one would not disrespect others just because they are different from us. We would still have to deal with error, of course, our own and other people's, but surely monotheism, that extraordinarily rare insight, includes the insight that present in every genuine human response to the divine, there's a genuine sense of mystery, of the sacred, however limited and however distorted. Teilhard de Chardin, to me, is the best in all this. He doesn't define God, of course, but he says God is the heart and the beyond of everything. That is such a good statement. So if I dismiss you entirely, can't you see I'm dismissing God? If we had it yesterday in the readings, Nicodemus, the Pharisee, humble, comes by night because he's dark. He's seen Jesus empty the temple and he's heard him, and he thinks, God, I've got it all wrong, but I don't know what's right. So he can't. He's trying to work it out, and he's got a PhD in theology, and he's spent all his life on it. Now he's got to admit that he's wrong. Join the mob. So he then comes to Jesus by night, and Jesus talks about the Spirit. The wind blows where it wills, and you don't know where it comes from or where it goes. So it is with the Spirit of God, Nicodemus. Don't be so locked into your training and your thoughts and your... They're only your thoughts. There's a lot of beauty in them, but don't get locked in. Be ready to see the presence of the mysterious God everywhere, anywhere. Dylan Thomas. Van Gogh. Shakespeare. Your little daughter who's learning the piano. Everywhere. So the prophets weren't always conscious of this, and you're going to soon see that. God's a Jew, he's on our side, he's with us or he's against us and he's using them, but my God, he's certainly not a Babylonian and he's not this and he's not that and he's not an Egyptian, you with me? God is our God, he's the one God and he's ours. Well, if you've only got one God and he's ours, what the heck's going on with all these other people? Where do they get born? What's going on? Doesn't mean they're always all right or we're always all right. I hope you get what I mean. But as you're watching these texts, be aware that they're coming from an assumption about God or assumptions about God that are very defective. No wonder they crucified Jesus, because he didn't have that. He sits down with a Samaritan woman, and the text is really clear. Jews don't talk to Samaritans, not women anyhow, but not Samaritans either. And he says, listen, sweetheart, could you give me some of that water? I'm dying of thirst. You're talking to me for, you know, point. So he does. And so, you know, this gospel, beautiful gospel. It was too much for people to take, so they crucified him and they crucified his followers. A second insight, or lack of insight, which I conclude with, and here it is this idea of a controlling God. I hope to put this well, and I don't want you to believe me. I want you to hear, of course, and you can check it, but check it. An assumption prevalent throughout the Old Testament is that God controls nature and history such that happenings that are judged to be good are seen as expressions of God's blessing. Happenings that are judged to be bad are seen as expressions of God's disapproval and punishment. So I and my wife had a beautiful little child. God is blessing, of course God is blessing us, but God is blessing us with this child. My wife, after 6 months pregnancy, the child was died or in the womb or whatever. So very easy for people to say, God's not blessing us here. God is punishing us maybe, or maybe I shouldn't have had sex before marriage, or, you know, the human, the insecure human being does all this. We all do it. It's kind of almost natural. But you kind of think of one as a blessing and one as a punishment, or God is angry. You following me? It's a tendency they had. They didn't question it. I'm suggesting we need to question it. In our human experience, power is often abused. It's often expressed as control. When the authors think of God as almighty, they're declaring their faith that there are no limits to God's power. So, if Jerusalem is destroyed, Jerusalem is destroyed, God must have intended it. Do you get it? So we must have done something wrong. You and I might think, maybe the Babylonians had better ammunition. Maybe they had a bigger army. Maybe they won because they were more powerful from the point of view of military. Maybe we didn't do anything wrong at all. Maybe they're doing something wrong. Do you get me? We have to think through these things, surely. Well, they don't. Because God is the one puppeteering, pulling everything, organizing everything. And so that mentality, which is not dead today, but it was rampant then and universal then, it's in the prophets as well. I think you'll find it. They haven't yet come to the insight that I think is so clear in Jesus, that God is love. And consequently, the power God has is the power of love. It's God's love that has no limits. Love power is the greatest. In fact, it's the only thing that's really powerful. If you know French, pouvoir, power, in French is the ability to enable. Power is a good thing. It enables. But power can also be, can't it, controlling. So the danger is to think of God as the arch-controller, rather than the arch-empowerer who takes our freedom seriously and lives with it. On the final page, the prophets are clear in presenting the compassion and fidelity of God. They're also aware of the responsibility of human beings for bringing about the suffering that we experience. They're not blind to those obvious things. However, and you check this as you read them, they still portray God as the one who organizes the disasters that afflict Israel and Judah. If we were good, we wouldn't have been destroyed by the Babylonian army. We were, so we must have been bad. How were we bad? What should we have done? Can you follow the logic? But it actually doesn't work unless God decides who's going to win the war. The prophets thought God was choosing a foreign power to punish Israel. In their world, the gods were the important thing. So if Babylon defeated Israel, the Babylonian god must have been more powerful than the Israelite god. Got the logic? That's how they all thought, every culture. They didn't think that, these prophets. So their only way of working out all that is, well, God must have been the one that let the Babylonians win. Our God, the powerful God. So God's the one. Now if he let them win, not their own God, because their God couldn't be more powerful than our God, and there is only one God and he's ours. So if God organised it, well, God's just. God wouldn't punish us if we hadn't done something wrong. So where did we go wrong? That's the first question that they ask. Their aim in speaking as they did was to direct people's attention to the actual circumstances of their life, to the presence and action of God offering them life and calling them to respond in faith. We've learned, have we, not to look to God as the direct cause of the happenings that come from the free and random emergence of the cosmos or from human sinfulness. This is the world we have. It's creaking and groaning, and the plates are bumping up against each other. And it's a wonderful world if we not destroy it. But part of its wonder is that there's going to be earthquakes, and there's going to be tsunamis, aren't there? And there's going to be volcanoes. It's all part of this world we're in. Well, God isn't working out, all right, well, oh God, we haven't had a volcano for a week. Volcano, there. I know they're bad people there. Because there was a volcano. All these other peoples who aren't anywhere near where the plates come together are all good people because they didn't have a volcano. That's beautiful. It's a bit simplistic and hardly very helpful. So we've learnt to think differently about that, I hope, and to see God as loving us in whatever happens to us. He didn't love Jesus less on the cross, and that's why the crucifixion is so important. They thought if you're punished, if you're sick, or killed, you're being punished by God. Look at Jesus. Innocent, beautiful, loving, yet crucified. So that it kind of, they had to think differently, clearly, to see that God is loving Jesus through it, and God is loving us through it, and God's loving you in the ups and downs of your life. And the ups don't mean you're being blessed, and the downs mean you're not being blessed. That often is brought about by other people, or because you're in a volcanic area, or because you live just near the coast and there's a tidal wave, or you live in Alabama, was it, where they had the twist, what do you call them?
Yeah.
So tornadoes, so that's where you happen to be living. Well, whether you should live there is another matter, but you are. So it's all that mixed up stuff, where the question is not, what is God doing in the world? And you work that out by what's happening. The only question worth reflecting on, whatever's happening, where is God in this? Where was God on Calvary? He was in Jesus. He was in the beautiful mother. He was with the beloved disciple. He was with the soldier who was sorry what happened. And he was with the bloke who tried to give him a little bit of something to stop the pain. You know, the military tough bugger who put up the thing. And so he's all over the place. Wherever there's... Well, didn't we have it recently? Did you see the coronation? I only saw the bit in the church. I wasn't bothered with the rest of it. But ubi caritas in amor. They sang Deus ibi est. Where there is love, that's where God is. So if you're in a situation that's not working for anybody, put some love into it and God is there. So, my dear lovely people, that's it. And next week my aim will be to only one day spend it on the prophecy of Amos. My advice, if I were you, thank God, but if I were you, I would read Amos before I came to the lecture so that I've, or if you read a commentary, you've got my commentary there. And by the way, if you ran out of books, there's some in the thing, I've got more. But whatever you do, and by the way, if you want a book, and haven't got the money, just take it and pay when you've got enough money to pay for it. I've already had to pay for them, so there's no problem.